The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll. You're too familiar, and
I don't see you anymore. I'd like to welcome all of you to this program. I'm Gary Knoll. Not in the studio now, out filming. Wonderful show ahead of you today. My guest in the second part will be Arne Gunderson, and we're going to talk about why you should not accept at face value anything being said about the safety of our nuclear reactors. We have 104 in the United States. We've been told by the nuclear industry and by its senior spokespersons, ours are safe. Ours are not like Fukushima. Well, they're not telling you the truth. Gunderson, who worked for 39 years in the nuclear power industry as a nuclear power engineer and who's very experienced, will tell you why we should be extremely concerned and why we should all be working together, no matter what your background, on closing down these plants. They are not safe, they are not green, and they are not cost effective. So that's in the second part of our program. Next week, a full 1 hour interview with Dr. Judy Wood for part two. More forensic investigation into how the World Trade Center towers tumbled on 9/11. And now she will talk about the actual technology involved and a person who can actually prove it, who understands the technology and can actually describe exactly how it can occur. That's a first. I'm not aware this person's ever done an interview before. And then today, we'll be doing an issue that I'm going to ask you to call in and share your points of view on. From the Independent UK, John Harry. It's not just Dominic Strauss-Kahn, the International Monetary Fund itself should be on trial. My own comments and commentary on that as well. Time permitting, I want to address all of those of you in this audience, and there are many, who hold to the belief that global warming is not man-made and that it's been oversold and overblown. I respect your right to have an opinion. Will you respect mine to show you the facts of how you've been misled and therefore the information you're basing your decisions on is completely misguided? I'll be talking about peak oil and a change in the world that's coming because we are past peak oil. But unless I give you the details and a real scholarship and explain why we are being misled, who's being responsible for this, how are they doing it, then you'll just think, well, what's there to fear? A lot. A commentary from James Hansen, silence is deadly in speaking nothing about the Canadian-U.S. tar sands pipeline. They want to build it right through the United States from Canada to Texas. It's only going to carry about 800,000 barrels a day, but boy, what it could do to our environment to devastate it really bad, especially in light of this small spill up at in Yellowstone Park. So, commentary on that. Again, I don't know how many of these I'll get to. I'll get to as many as I can. Let's begin. Always on something on health, healing, and empowerment. You go into the average American's refrigerator, and you're going to see a lot of food compared to other people in the world. The problem is not the grapes or the fresh vegetables that you have, or even the milk or the grains or the meat that you might have. It's how much of it you do not consume and therefore waste. Let me put it in perspective. We waste more food each day in the United States than it would be to feed all of the hungry people, that's 700 million, in India for a week. That's right. Let me give you an example. We throw out 22 pounds out of every 72 pounds of fresh produce, fruit. We throw out 39 pounds out of every 131 pounds of vegetables. We throw out 34% of the milk of 134 pounds, I should say, of the 160 pounds of milk. Of grains, we throw out 36 pounds that goes to waste out of 173 pounds. And of poultry, for every 70 pounds of poultry, people waste 27 pounds. Of fish, it's 4 pounds of every out of every 15. Just simple things like nuts, we throw out a pound for every 9 pound. And of red meat, we throw out 36 pounds out of every 103 pounds. In other words, we waste more food than any other country in the world, and that includes China and India combined as a percentage of waste per household. So not only do we use 25% of all the energy in the world, and yet we only have 4.6% of all the population, but we are wasting things. So here's my suggestion. Let's do something that the French do. And I noticed this when I was in France. And when I'm there and I'm in the countryside and I'm asking people about their lifestyle, one of the first things I look at is their diet and their state of health and their disease patterns. The French go almost daily. They take their time. They go out and they do their shopping. They love everything. They love their breads fresh baked that morning. In fact, you'll see them lined up, and a lot of times they lined up with bicycles at the bakeries at 5 and 6 o'clock in the morning to get their fresh loaves of bread, which are about 3 feet long. They're long, long, long loaves of bread. Then they like to go and get their fresh produce right from the farmer's market. But again, they don't like to get there later in the day. They like to get there early. They like to get up early. They get their shopping done early. And if you look in the average cupboard, in the average refrigerator, you don't see a lot of food. But you do see each day at a meal so many fruits and vegetables and grains and fresh fish and always grapes on the table or different fruit depending upon season. It's daily. Very little wastage. That's also true in a lot of Italian homes as well. So why don't we try this for just, I'm asking you to try this for 1 month. Each week, go on either Wednesday, Friday, or Saturday, because that's when most are open, your farmers markets, and buy what you need for the next 3 days only. Don't buy more, just buy for 3 days. And try to bring something new in. Also each week, try to go to a market you normally would not shop at, like a Korean market, Japanese market, Chinese market, Spanish market, Italian market, Indian market in Manhattan. There's 27th, 28th Street on Lex. You can find hundreds of items you would not normally find, and that's where the Indians go. The prices are terrific. It's just a beautiful experience to walk into a store, and the smells overwhelm you, smells you would not normally smell. The grains, the split peas, the things they make their dal and other curries and pastes and soups with. And if you want the best prices for mushrooms, go down to Chinatown. They hold the mushrooms from the ceiling in these strings, and you just want a pound, and a pound of mushrooms from Chinatown would cost you less than 2 ounces from a health food store. So you save money. You increase the variety of items in your diet, and you don't waste. And just make sure that you really think of portion sizes. Also, for those of you who may be overweight, I would like for you to actually look at how much you're preparing. And here's the key. Don't eat in between meals and don't eat while you're cooking because it's going to kill your appetite. Now, if you are overweight and you want to reduce your appetite, it's easy. This is the easiest, safest, healthiest thing you can do. A half hour before a meal, take some ice, put it in a glass of mineral water, and put the juice of 2 lemons in the glass and drink that. That immediately shuts off your appetite. You won't have the same desire to eat food. Lemon ice water is the best way of killing desire for food, and it's especially good at night. Then actually measure out. Take a bowl and measure out, and a cup and measure out. And remember, your food servings are measured by cups, not bowls. and or ounces in the case of nuts, but I don't really care about the measurement of nuts. I just say take a handful of walnuts, a handful of almonds, a handful of whatever, sunflower seeds, because there's so much fiber and the oils are so healing and good for you, it's not a weight issue. And by the way, to prove that, I took a group of people who were chronically overweight. I divided them into half, 50 and 50. This is one of the 47 different clinical studies I've done. And for the people who were overweight in one group, I told them not to count calories. Instead, I gave them living foods only, meaning they could have nothing that was cooked more than 118 degrees. So the life force, the enzymes, the energy was still present. And 75% of it was raw. I called it a 100% living food diet. Now, that's not a 100% raw food diet. It's living food. And so they could have all the salads they wanted. They could throw nuts in the salads. They could have different stir fries, providing they could stick their finger in that stir fry. They were making a tomato sauce, stick your finger in it. If you're cooking in Italy, it's a slow cooking. You can put your finger in. If you burn your finger, it's too hot. If you don't, fine. And it'll always taste sweeter. When you're cooking tomatoes, by the way, and you cook them slowly at low heat, you bring out natural sugars in them. In any case, the other group, I restricted them in calories. At the end of 3 months, the group that was not restricted in calories but had to eat living foods, high in fiber, lost an average of 32 pounds. The other group that was on a restricted caloric diet lost 6 pounds. Now, when we added up the total calories, the people that were on the living food actually ate more calories than they normally would have been eating, but it was from living food. Therefore, living food and non-allergenic food impacts metabolism differently. Next up, a long time ago, I found out that vitamin C was very important in helping people with serious illnesses. And I had been an advocate of getting higher doses. But I experimented upon myself, and I've told many times the story how while I was doing my radio show on 83rd Street where I lived, I'd have an IV drip in my arm for 4 hours. I was getting 200,000 milligrams a day, 6 days a week. And then every 6 days, I would have a full, it would cost me about $1,200, blood chemistry to check my immune system. And why did I do this? Because never having smoked, taken drugs, eaten junk foods, except maybe as a kid, I tried different things, as all kids do, but not as an adult. And was I able to show what I could do with a healthy immune system? And then what would that mean for a sick immune system? And then I did an experiment. I stressed myself intentionally by training up to 100 to 125 miles a week. To give you an idea, that's running a marathon a day. I would get up at 4 and finish my workout by 9, 5 hours of training each day and doing multiple marathons and everything else. That's the year I did 82 races. Did well in them, but then it really hit my immune system. But I was measuring, all right, what will this therapy I'm giving myself do to an immune system that's being challenged? And it helped me rebound tremendously. And that's when I decided that let's see what it does with people who already have a challenged immune system. And lo and behold, it made all the difference in the world. And that's where we began to help people who had advanced AIDS, cancer, and other conditions. All, of course, under medical treatment because it was the medical doctors doing the actual therapies, but I was the one creating the protocols. And that's how a lot of other holistic doctors and nutritionists and nurses began to use those protocols because every single day they were over there at the center and looking at the progress. A lot of people said, well, why are you using vitamin C? I said, because it's enormously important if you have cancer because it can kill cancer cells. They said, well, we're not so sure. This is new. This is from science now. This goes to all the scientists. This is from the Mayo Clinic. Quote, the long dormant debate over vitamin C's usefulness for cancer therapy may be about to reignite. researchers have found that injecting mice with high doses of vitamin C staved off tumor growth. The findings could upend the established view that vitamin C is useless as a cancer treatment. The idea that high doses of vitamin C might help cancer patients first surfaced in the late 1970s and sparked a heated debate within the research community. So now this Dr. Levine and a physician and cell biologist at the National Institutes of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases has found that, along with colleagues, that high doses of vitamin C delivered directly to tumors and that it made an enormous difference. Quote, they inject half of the rodents with enough vitamin C so the concentration in the fluids around the cells would reach at least 10 millimoles. Tumors in the mice that received the shots grew by 41 to 50% less than the growth of mice that did not receive the treatment. In humans, the concentration of ascorbic acid in the extracellular fluid normally doesn't climb higher than 0.2 millimoles. But in other studies, researchers have injected humans with the same solution that gave the mice and increased vitamin C in the blood to more than 10 millimoles. And these recipients showed far fewer adverse effects. And then the results show that the high doses of injected vitamin C could be another weapon against cancer. And this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So here you have America's number one scientific magazine, a major university, and it shows what we've been saying for a long time, that vitamin C has enormous power when you use it and know what you're doing and how to use it in individuals, how you grade up gradually the dosage, and then how you peak it and then bring it down gradually. And we have an awful lot of people, I mean a lot of people, and they are on film, and we have their medical records who can show. But you see, because we're not official, you had to wait 25 years until it's official. So now if doctors chose to use it, they could, because it's officially recognized as an important non-toxic tool. And finally, broccoli may undo diabetes damage. Eating broccoli could reverse the damaging effects to the diabetic and to heart blood vessels. University of Warwick, a team of scientists, they found the key in broccoli. It's called sulforaphane. But hold on a second. You've been hearing about sulforaphane for years. Yes, but now it's official, because it's the BBC News broadcasting it, and it's in the journal Diabetes, and it's a major scientific study at a major institute. So now they're knowing today that the brassica family, of which broccoli is one, encourages the production of enzymes which protect the blood vessels and the reduction of high levels of molecules which cause cells to damage. So when you have your broccoli, and you have your broccoli sprouts and the both together, you're protecting yourself from damage from diabetes. Oh, and by the way, there just one more thing here from a major study showed that that citrus rinds, the peel of citrus like the orange, the lemon, the lime, the tangerine, it can help remove toxins. Yep. It's a great detoxifier. Why? Because they found something unique to them. Have you heard about this? Modified citrus pectin, made from citrus peel. A natural antidote if you have lead, mercury, cadmium toxicity, especially if you have children. Of course you have. Which is one of the protocols I'm offering when I help people who have autistic children. I put them on a special protocol that includes modified citrus pectin twice a day. But they've just discovered it because they did the research, and now it's official. Modified citrus pectins. But hold on, didn't we talk about this helping cancer? Yeah, that too. That was 12 years ago. Yep. So you see, wait long enough and they catch up with you. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Now, of course, I'm sure you've paid attention to Fox News trying to vindicate itself and all the other commentaries lashing out the Nancy Graces, the very unhappy people under any circumstance, and absolutely outraged now that they didn't get the verdict they felt was necessary. The jury, of course, is never going to be right when they end up being wrong. And, of course, just like with the McMartin case where there was sexual molestation, but then again, it didn't happen, and the jury found them completely innocent after 7 years, no one apologized. But in this case of Dominic Strauss-Kahn, I had two issues that bothered me. One was similar to the white woman who was beaten and mugged and raped around the reservoir. And that made a lot of news. Everyone got on that story. I talk with friends who are in the police departments, and I ask, could you find out how many Latino and African American women were raped or mugged during that same period of time? And I believe it was 47. Not a word. So if you're a white woman, or if you're a wealthy white woman, that makes a difference. Or if you're a famous wealthy white woman, or if one of your family is famous and you're a wealthy white woman, then suddenly that rape is important to us. But if you're African-American, Latino, or any other culture, and you're not rich and you're not poor and your dad, mom are not famous, then it's not in the news cycle. So it bothers me what we pay attention to as a philosophical issue. But what really bothered me about this Dominic Strauss-Kahn case was that all the emphasis was on him. Nothing was on the International Monetary Fund. Now, having done a lot of research and written a couple of articles on the International Monetary Fund, and I'm in the process of doing a documentary on globalization as we speak, and International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and their various treaties and their sponsors, this is serious. What if the media had not just looked at him and then allowed the court system to decide his innocence or guilt, but rather looked at the International Monetary Fund and what it had done to innocent people just in recent years? That is, would we have felt the same? But they didn't. Virtually all the media, left and right, conservative and liberal, none of them focused upon that part of it. Now, to understand this story I'm going to share with you now, you have to go back to the birth of the International Monetary Fund, which was 1944. The countries that were poised to win the Second World War gathered in a hotel room in rural New Hampshire, and they divided up the spoils of war, with a few honorable exceptions, and like the great British economist John Maynard Keynes, the negotiations were determined by one thing only. They wanted to build a global financial system that ensured that those moneyed and powerful interests would be able to control the resources on this planet and keep them. They set up a series of institutions designed for that purpose. And as a result, the International Monetary Fund came into existence. Now, the International Monetary Fund's official job sounds simple and attractive. It supposedly is there to ensure poor countries don't fall into debt. And if they do, well, by golly, we're going to go in there and lift them right up, because we're going to give them some low-interest loans, and we're going to give them our economic expertise, and it's going to help the poor. We're going to be the best friend and the guardian of the poor. Noble gesture. I support that. And even beyond the rhetoric, the International Monetary Fund was designed to be dominated by just a few rich countries, and more specifically, by their bankers and financial speculators. The International Monetary Fund works in their interest every step of the way. But let us not deal in vagaries or generalities. That is not my nature. If you listen to this program, you know I'm very specific. Let's look at how this plays out in the real world. In the 1990s, a small country in southeastern Africa called Malawi, M-A-L-A-W-I, was facing a severe economic problem after enduring one of the worst HIV/AIDS epidemics in the world and surviving a horrific dictatorship. They asked the International Monetary Fund for help. And if the International Monetary Fund has acted in its official role, it would have given them loans and guided the country to develop in the same way that Britain and the United States and every other successful country had developed, by protecting their smaller industries, subsidizing the farmers, and investing in the education and health of the people. Okay, well, that's reasonable. Thus far, no problem. But unfortunately, that's not what they did. They did something a little different. That's what the institution was concerned about. They told the world, we're concerned about ordinary people, and we're accountable to them. But the International Monetary Fund did something behind the press's eyes. They said they would only give assistance to Malawi if they agreed upon what was called structural adjustments. In fact, they demanded structural adjustments. They ordered Malawi to sell off all of their state-owned property to private companies, and those presidents and board members of private companies just happened, just as a coincidence, to be aligned with the members of the International Monetary Fund. And then they got the speculators involved. And again, these speculators just coincidentally and probably just accidentally happened to go to the same elite schools and belong to the same boards of directors and had the same golf clubs. But outside of that, I'm sure that there wasn't any collusion. And then they said, you've got to stop spending on your population. They demanded they stop subsidizing fertilizer, even though it was the only thing that made it possible for farmers, most of the population were farmers, to grow anything in the country's feeble and depleted soil. They told them to prioritize giving money to international bankers over giving money to the Malawian people. So when the 2001 Malawian government representatives met with the International Monetary Fund, someone in the Malawian government mentioned that they had taken the opportunity to build up some large stockpiles of grain in case there was a crop failure so they could feed the people. And at that meeting, and we have proof of this, the International Monetary Fund representatives demanded they sell off all, every single grain in the country to private companies at once. They told Malawi to get their priorities straight. They were to take that grain, sell it, and pay off a loan from a large bank the International Monetary Fund had told them to take out in the first place. And the interest rate, 56% annually. The Malawian president protested and said this was dangerous. But he had no choice. The grain was sold. The banks were paid. The next year, the crops failed. The Malawian government had almost nothing to hand out. The people starved to death in enormous numbers. Many people were reduced to eating the bark off trees and any rats they could capture. The BBC described it as Malawi's, quote, worst ever famine, unquote. There had been a much worse crop failure in 1991 and 92, but there was no famine because the government had grain stockpiled to distribute. So, yes, they had drought, but they had grain stored, and they distributed it. So at least 1,000 innocent people starved to death who didn't have to. At the height of the starvation, the International Monetary Fund wanted to squeeze some more out of Malawi, so they suspended a $47 million aid package because the government had, quote, slowed down, according to a letter that I have, in implementing the marketing of, quote, reforms that had led to the disaster. ActionAid, the leading provider of help on the ground, conducted an autopsy into the famine. They concluded that the IMF, International Monetary Fund, quote, bears responsibility completely for this disaster, unquote. Then in this starved wreckage, Malawi did something poor countries are not supposed to do. They told the International Monetary Fund, please leave us. Get out. Suddenly free to answer to their own people rather than foreign bankers, Malawi disregarded all of the International Monetary Fund's expert advice and brought back subsidies for the fertilizer along with a range of other services to ordinary people. Within 2 years, the country had transformed from being a beggar to being so abundant they were supplying food to Uganda and Zimbabwe. The Malawian famine should have been a distant warning cry for you and me. Subordinating the interest of ordinary people to bankers and speculators caused starvation there. Within a few years, it had crashed the global economy for us as well. In the history of the International Monetary Fund, this story is not an exception. It is the absolute rule. The organization takes over poor countries, promising it has medicine that will cure them, and then pours poisons down their throats. Whenever I travel across the poor parts of the world, I see the scars from International Monetary Fund's structural adjustment everywhere, from Peru to Ethiopia. Whole countries have collapsed after being International Monetary Funded up, and most famously Argentina and Thailand in the 1990s. Look at some of the organization's greatest hits. In Kenya, the International Monetary Fund insisted the government introduce fees to see a doctor, so the number of women seeking help and advice fell by 65%. Then, in Ghana, the International Monetary Fund insisted the government introduce fees for going to school. The number of rural families who could afford to send their kids crashed by 80%. In Zambia, the International Monetary Fund insisted they slash health spending, and the number of babies who died doubled. Amazingly enough, it turns out that shoveling your country's money into foreign bankers rather than your own people isn't a great development strategy. I filmed the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz for a film that will be out in about a year. I put it on hold in post-production because I'm working on four other post-production films, one which will be released in about a month from now, actually less than a month. But in this, Joseph Stiglitz worked closely with the International Monetary Fund for over 10 years until he quit and became a whistleblower. And he said, quote, when the International Monetary Fund arrives in a country, they are interested in only one thing. How do we make sure the banks and financial institutions are paid? It is the International Monetary Fund that keeps the financial speculators in business. They're not interested in development or what helps a country to get out of poverty, unquote. Some people call the International Monetary Fund inconsistent because the institution supports huge state-funded bank bailouts in the rich world while demanding an end to almost all state funding in the poor world. But that's only an inconsistency if you're thinking about the realm of intellectual ideas rather than the raw economic interest. In every situation, the International Monetary Fund does what will get more money to bankers and speculators. If rich countries will hand banks money for nothing, in bailouts, great. If poor countries can be forced to hand banks money to extort repayments, great. It's absolutely consistent. And some people claim that Strauss-Kahn was a reformer who changed the International Monetary Fund after he took over in 2009. Certainly there was a shift in rhetoric, but detailed study by Dr. Daniela Gabor of the University of West of England has shown that the substance is business as usual. Look, for example, at Hungary. After the 2008 crash, the International Monetary Fund lauded them for keeping to their original deficit target by slashing public services. The horrified Hungarian people responded by kicking the government out and choosing a party that promised to make the banks pay for the crisis they created. They introduced an 0.7% levy on the banks, four times higher than anywhere else. the International Monetary Fund went crazy. They said this was highly distortive for banking activity, unlike the bailouts, of course, and shrieked that it would cause the banks to flee from the country. But the collapse predicted by the International Monetary Fund in Hungary did not happen. Hungary kept on pursuing sensible moderate measures instead of punishing the population. They imposed taxes on the hugely profitable sectors of retail, energy, and telecoms, and took funds from private pensions to pay the deficit. The International Monetary Fund shrieked at every step and demanded cuts for ordinary Hungarians instead. It was the same old agenda with the same old threads and threats. Strauss Kahn did the same in almost all the poor countries where the International Monetary Fund operated, from El Salvador to Pakistan to Ethiopia, where big cuts to subsidies for ordinary people have been imposed. So you see, there's the story that didn't get a single line of attention anywhere. Instead, the idea, was he guilty or was he innocent? That's none of my business. That's for the jury and for the court, for his defense, and history determine. But boy, have we missed the important issues in our country. I'm Gary Nall. Your thoughts. Call us now at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Taking your calls on the issue that, remember, in the United States, Bill Clinton was one of the biggest cheerleaders in his administration and his wife, Hillary Clinton, for the International Monetary Fund, George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., and now the number one cheerleader, Barack Obama, and the people around him. So giving a little balance to what they really do. Let's go into our studio and say hello to Melissa, and I am told Jason. Hi, Melissa. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Gary. Good afternoon. Yesterday, people were mentioning that there were birds squawking in the background yesterday when you were on the radio. People would like to know, where are you, and also what do you hope to film on your on this outing, please? And I know that you're going to be filming underneath one of the ledges of the Antarctic glacier soon. Would you be able to talk about that?
What I'm hopeful to do in this outing is to film throughout the Amazon, taking a dirigible, like a blimp, that flows just over the treetops to show how much deforestation has occurred and how this has impacted the great Amazon and how it's impacted the people along the Amazon. I'll also be hopefully interviewing people who are affected by the planting of genetically engineered soy for exporting to China and other countries. I'm also hopeful we'll be able to get some new footage of Antarctica, because one of the things that we haven't done yet is explain to people how these two gigantic, the two largest glaciers in the world on land, one's the size of Spain, one's the size of France, that's what's melting. The trouble is they're melting from underneath. And if I can, I want to get up underneath underneath the shelf and show these giant hollow bubble-like areas, because the warm water's coming up and it's melting from underneath, causing it to skittle faster. So that's also, I'm going to try to get, my goal is to get more filming of dead zones and talk more about the circulation of plastic in the Atlantic, so I can tie that back into why we should not be using anything that's not biodegradable and get it into people's consciousness, there's a consequence to this. Filming out into the middle of the Pacific, an area that's the size of Texas, this just gigantic masses of plastic, and show all the dead whales and dolphins and seabirds and fish that mistake the plastic for food and consume it and die. This time out, that's what I'm hoping to do. And there was a bird sanctuary yesterday where I stopped for the show. I stop wherever I can to do the show, and there were all kinds of birds in the background. So that's what you heard, but not today. Different location.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Anything else?
Yes, I do actually have a few. In New York State, it looks as though they will be allowing fracking to happen. In the news, it says it's a good thing. But why is it so bad to frack, please? Could you let us all know?
Well, there's several reasons. First, because a person will receive a relatively small amount of money for the rights to frack. Or they will receive no money because the energy cartels have been buying up mineral rights that no one ever thinks about. Because when you buy a piece of property, you're generally thinking about having a house and nice views. You don't think about minerals because people are not into going after minerals. But most people don't realize when you buy land, do you own the minerals or water rights or air rights? And many people don't. That doesn't stop them from buying the property, because it's not always that someone comes on your property and then claims right to it. But they can. If they own the mineral rights, they could literally come and put an oil rig right next to your house and you couldn't do a thing about it. The law's on their side because they made sure the laws were written for them. Next, they've said that they're going to keep it out of state parks and away 100 feet away. Once you frack, you're putting enormous amount of water under great pressure and chemical solvents to break open the shell to release the gases trapped and then bring it up. That is millions of water per well, and that does not stay in one place. That can seep into an underground aquifer, a stream, and then that can pollute something 100 miles away. So if you're within 100 miles downstream of a fracking, you could have your water and soil polluted. It also pollutes the air. It's very toxic. And it's not profitable. I believe this is a bubble. I'm going to go on the record right now and say officially, from my point of view, that what you're seeing is a massive energy speculative bubble. And this bubble will collapse because the investors will see, after all the money they put in to buy up all these leases all over America, that they're not going to get a return on their money. It's a lot of promise, but there's no substance. It's very expensive to extract the gas, not natural gas in a natural pool, but from the shell. It's very expensive. Okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
And our guest is on hold, but we'll go over and say hello to Jason first. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Gary, how are you?
Good.
I know you've told me repeatedly not to discuss numbers with you on air, but I've been doing radio for over a decade now at places like WNEW 102.7 in New York, at SiriusXM satellite radio station, and at no time have I seen one show grow so fast, so quickly, as your Monday night show, which is 7 o'clock Progressive Commentary Hour, Eastern Standard Time. It had 100,000 downloads as of this morning. This is more I'm sorry?
No, that's surprising.
This is more downloads than all of programs on Pacifica and NPR combined. We have really given the young people, teens, adults a place to listen, voice their views, opinions. Last week we had that homesteading lecture that you did, which was just free, and we had to get more bandwidth to deal with the mass amount of people coming to our website. So we really thank everyone, and we're proud to say we are the place to go for progressive liberals and conservatives who have found now their new home to listen to whatever they can with no bias. We have no advertisement in the mainstream, no articles, no interviews, so we're really happy. And also now we have our new show in the Caribbean with the Yolanda Roy called Caribbean Spice, debuting Mondays after your show at 7 p.m.
Oh, by the way, this Monday I'm devoting my entire hour to the Federal Reserve and showing you for the first time, I'm not aware this has ever been done on radio or television in American history. I'm going to show you who all the members are of all the Federal Reserve banks and then connect them to other organizations, including the International Monetary Fund and the Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation. I'll show you the web. It's scholarly. It's a matter of record. My results are always researched prior to going on the air, so it will stand. That's a whole hour Monday evening, 7 to 8, over Progressive Radio Network. And it's just one theme per week of commentary, my own or someone else's. This week it's my own. And hopefully that'll open up another way of looking at who controls the Fed and how they control the money supply. And by that, an awful lot of speculation. Good, thank you. By the way, that Caribbean show, just a point. I was on a Caribbean show. Very nice guy. He was kind enough to have me on to talk about autism. But it's kind of frenetic, and it was mainly music. And this is going to be a very different show. I want to see every single country in the Caribbean talk, have a person on every week, bringing the world what's happening in their cultural, important political issues. Then there'll be health, there'll be music, there'll be wonderful balance. But we don't know about the Caribbean unless you go there. I go there. But the average American has clueless about what's going on in Trinidad, for example, doesn't know, or in Cuba. So if anyone in this audience comes from the Caribbean and would like to contribute as an on-air from anywhere in the world over Skype, on-air a little commentary for a few minutes about your country each week, call Jason, let him know. This way we have many people reporting. Okay?
Let me just get my phone number so people can call. 646-926-5428.
Okay, thank you. And also, Jason, I'm still looking. I've hired two producers. I need two more producers to work on, who have experience working with editors, working with film. I'm filming. I have a lot of stuff filmed. I'm out of editors. We're packed. I've just bought a whole new system. We have state-of-the-art equipment and systems. We have great editors, but we're short on producers to work with them because it takes two people to sit there when I finish filming and put that film together. So they should call you. These are full-time paying and very nicely paying positions and exciting films they'll be working on.
Yep, they could definitely call. Just again, 646-926-5428. Thanks, Gary.
And 10 of the biggest heavyweight thinkers and household names in the progressive world have all agreed to do shows, and we'll be announcing who they are next week. I'm going over now and say hello to my guest, Arne Gunderson. I gave his background earlier. He's given testimony before congressional, state, and government agencies and officials throughout the U.S., Canada, and internationally on these issues. And he was appointed by the Vermont Senate president to be the first chair of the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant Oversight Panel. And he also has testified even in foreign countries before the Czech Republic Senate. And he's the author of the first Department of Energy's decommissioning handbook. And he also calculated radiation releases to children with health problems who live near nuclear facilities. Nice to have you with us today, Arne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Arne, I'm going to turn this over to you just by asking you a couple questions, all right?
Okay.
We've been led to believe that Fukushima's catastrophe was just a fluke, a one-off, once in a lifetime, never happen again, that our nuclear facilities, well, we have contingencies. We have plan B, C, D, and E. It's never going to have a meltdown. No problems. Our reactors are better made, and therefore, don't worry. Don't even think about closing them down. They're safe. They're green. They're efficient. Now tell us, from your perspective, what you can prove and what you have evidence to support is the truth about the safety of America's 104 nuclear reactors.
Well, thanks. It's interesting because on March 10th, the day before the Fukushima accident, you know, the industry's position was that the chance of a meltdown was roughly the same as being hit by a meteor. And then, of course, within a week, we had three meltdowns in a row. So if that logic is correct, this is, literally, forget once in a lifetime, a once in the life of the Earth phenomena. I don't think that's true. We've had three containments blow up at Fukushima. And that shouldn't be a surprise. Back in 1972, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission recognized that that type of containment, the type that's at Fukushima, was subject to problems. It's really small, and there's a lot of power inside it. So 40 years ago, people knew that that containment was a problem. Well, what they did was a series of backfits. They added things called vents. Well, you can't contain and have a vent on it. Those two are mutually incompatible. But that's what they did. And it's not just at Fukushima. It's at 23 reactors here in the U.S., a bunch of other reactors in Germany and in Japan, as well as a few other countries. Mexico has a few. So the problems begin 40 years ago with a design that everybody recognized at the time was a weak design. So it's not about a once-in-a-lifetime tsunami. It's about a design that was known 40 years ago to be a weak design. Now, it goes on from there. The fuel pools, the Japanese took this part of the piece a lot more seriously than the Americans. They took their fuel, which is stored in underwater here in the United States, and most of the Japanese fuel is stored in dry cask storage. And at Fukushima, those dry casks just survived just fine. But here in the United States, we take the opposite tack. We allow utilities to store it underwater about 100 feet high in the air in these fuel pools because it's cheaper. It saves money for the power plant owner rather than take it out and put it in dry casks. And I think you'll recall that Chairman Yasko of the NRC recommended a 50-mile evacuation at Fukushima. And the reason for that was the fuel pools. He was concerned that the Fukushima fuel pools might catch fire. And Brookhaven, right out on Long Island, has done a study about 12 years ago that said if one of these fuel pools catches fire, you would kill 186,000 people from the radiation that's within the fuel. So none of this is laughing matters, and none of it has anything to do about a tsunami. It's all about poor design and allowing reactors to minimize the cost while throwing the risk onto you and I.
Thank you for that oversight. A few quick answers, please. We're concerned about Indian Point, about 25 miles north of New York City. I'm concerned that it sets on a major earthquake fault, that it has poor designs, that it has had multiple problems over the last few years, that they immediately jump in and downplay their significance. But I'm really concerned about this, the solar flares hitting the ground and knocking out, unless there's major surge protectors, which right now there are not. So bad is it that the entire House of Representatives voted unanimously without a dissenting vote to support getting these backup generators in place. We don't have these. We don't have the backup generators. They're made in China with a three-year waiting list. If we actually have that solar flare hit, we're not prepared. That is going to knock out the power at that nuclear facility, and in 59 hours, that melts down. Then what happens after that?
Yeah, Indian Point is, 40 years old, and like you said, it's 26 miles away. By the way, I have a video up on the Riverkeeper website that talks about what you would do if you had to evacuate 50 miles and the difficulty of evacuating out to 50 miles. It's a video dedicated just to emergency planning. And again, it's on the Fairwinds website, my website, but it's also on Riverkeeper's website. But to talk to your point, and it's really an important point, it's called the Carrington effect. And about 150 years ago, right when telegraphs were coming in, the sun emitted a large solar flare. And this guy named Carrington observed the solar flare. And about a day later, enormous sparks were jumping from the wires and in the telegraph lines to the ground. And the scientists estimate that's about a 1 in 100 year event. Well, we're due for another solar flare of that magnitude. If it happens, you're absolutely right. It will knock out the grid. and shut down all the nuclear power plants in the country, as well as every power plant in the country. Basically, it will put the United States of America into a blackout. And you're right, again, the transformers that are all over the country, there's probably 10,000 of them that are at risk, would be burned out because we haven't taken adequate precautions. And they take 3 to 10 years to get new ones. So
Arne, hold your thought 1 second. I just want to say goodbye to our land-based stations throughout the United States and Canada. You can continue listening to this conversation over the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. If you forget ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, go to GaryNoll.com. And Sunday night, 8 p.m., over Progressive Radio Network, a health and nutrition hour only with your calls. That's 8 p.m. Sunday night. Now, let me just follow this line of thinking. So on the one hand, the nuclear reactors and their substations, and some of these are 100 tons, were made in Japan and China. Now Japan's been substantially limited in what it can manufacture. But China, I have to ask this question, China would also be affected. But then if it's affected by a solar flare, would it not at some level say, should we ship what we just made that we need off to America, or should we use it for ourselves? That's one thing. Secondly, NASA has flown 5 satellites through a hole 5 times wider than the planet Earth that historically had not been there, and that sphere, the magnetic sphere around the world, helped deflect magnetic flares on the 11-year cycle, so we really had no major calamities, just a little bit of light in the north and south pole, and a little bit of interference in electric, but nothing they couldn't fix overnight. I'm concerned about the following. I'd like for you to address it, please, Arne. I'm concerned that if a solar flare hits and there is no protection, then that's going to knock out the central generator and the backup generator and the substations. That's going to cause the nuclear generator to go on batteries, which is no more than 2 to 3 days. I just priced one of those batteries this morning. Just a house battery was $100,000. All right. I just spoke with a person I was interviewing, filming this morning to see what they're doing in South America. Secondly, you're going to have no telephone, no radio telephone, no cell phone, no computer, because the satellites would also be affected when that wave comes. So now how are you going to know that you've got a problem? How would a person know that a nuclear facility had a meltdown and the spent fuel rods enclosure had imploded? How would anyone know? You can't see, feel, or taste radiation. You would only know by getting radiation sickness. Even the authorities would be hard put to get that out to us, because they're going to be worrying about getting us water and food, since our water wouldn't work and our toilets wouldn't work and our refrigeration and freezers wouldn't work. So we're going to have, if on a full spectrum, from complete protection or no solar flares and no problem, clear over to the other side of that, where we get hit and we're not protected, we're not going to be able to get back online quickly. So we're going to be dealing with some very severe life-challenging issues, and radiation toxicity is one of them. Your thoughts on these, please.
The sophisticated electrical grids, like North America, the urban parts of China, and Europe would definitely be knocked out for years in an event like what we had 150 years ago. The nuclear plants would shut down, and they have about 6 days of diesel fuel on site to run the diesels to keep them cool. After that, they run out of diesel fuel, and the grid isn't there. You know, just like Fukushima, there's no power to be drawn on from the grid. So, in addition to authorities being worried about food and of course your refrigerators are all going to go, so all of the frozen items would disintegrate or deteriorate rather in less than 7 days. But added to that list of headaches then is authorities are going to be forced to ration diesel fuel and send it to the nuclear power plants. And hopefully the diesels will continue to run. But the real question is, how long can you keep getting diesel fuel into these nuclear plants in an event like this when the refineries are broken and there's no, you know, basically you're in a civil discord would occur. Can you count on getting diesel fuel to a nuclear plant when society has been ripped asunder by this Carrington effect wave? It's the thing that keeps me awake at night, I'll tell you.
Well, I'm very concerned because the American media has simply not touched this story at all. The government has not touched it at all. If nothing else, I would have expected the government to have come forward and given us all the reasons why this is not going to happen. But their own scientists at NASA say it is going to happen. As one said, quote, it will be like a Katrina punched in the stomach 1,000 times worse. So they've got to contradict their own NASA scientists. So they're simply not talking about it at all. So I'm going to continue talking about this because it's not quackery. It's not voodoo science. It is legitimate concern about trying to be proactive and giving people some positive solutions if it does happen, with the hope that it won't. But I've had enough of these, don't worry about Katrina. I was just filming down in the 9th lower ward of New Orleans, Arnie. I spoke with hundreds of people who told me the reason they didn't leave is because the Corps of Engineers promised them not to worry. Even a Category 5 hurricane would not flood them because of the levee, the dikes down there, and they believed them. Well, look what happened. No one at the Corps of Engineers went down later and apologized. So I believe that we should be concerned about the safety of nuclear plants. I believe that we should close them all down and decommission them and find a safe place, not Nevada, not in those terrible, the Yucca Mountain, which sits on multiple fault lines, but rather find a place where we could put concrete and titanium and steel encasements that would be 1,000 feet deep and 1,000 feet thick, so that we can entomb these damn things that we have made forever. Final thought from you, sir.
Well, getting back to this Carrington effect, you're right. You know, NASA's saying it's going to happen. And they've actually even proposed to Congress that they do something about it. There's about 20,000 transformers, big transformers, around the country. And if utilities would be forced into putting a surge protector on each one of those, this would be a non-event. When it happens, we're not talking about if it happens, but when it happens. And so we're talking about maybe $100,000 on 20,000 transformers around the country, and this problem goes away. And Congress doesn't want to talk about it. So I think...
Well, the Senate doesn't want, but the House already, Arnie, voted unanimously to support this. When they heard from NASA scientists, they, without one single dissenting vote, they said yes. So it's the Senate and utilities that are the problem. And we just have to keep pressure on and keep letters writing saying you must do something. I thank you for your good work. I look forward to another conversation. Arnie Gunderson, my guest, who has been an advisor for nearly 40 years on nuclear engineering, and a former nuclear industry senior vice president. And during his nuclear industry career, Arnie managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants around the country. He is a safety expert. He provides testimony on nuclear operations and safety and reliability and radiation issues to the National Regulatory Councils and Senate and state and federal governments. All the best to you, Arnie.
Thanks for having me.
Arnie Gunderson. I'm Gary Null. I thank you very much for listening. And for all those in this audience who have gone to an independent place to intelligently, properly, calmly, and rationally look at issues and then say, what is the best solution? Being an independent thinker is the first part of that equation. I look forward to sharing more on the next program. Have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kempf. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.